So, Brian, where do we find in McLuhan's books today?
What did we find in McLuhan's books today? Well, I was looking at a Wyndham Lewis book, I guess one of the more obscure Wyndham Lewis books, called Left Wings Over Europe.
Yeah, that's a good one. Mid-30s.
How to Start War Over Nothing, or How to Make a War Out of Nothing.
Yeah, that's mid-30s, Wyndham Lewis. He's now totally isolated, and he's just, you know, yelling at everybody.
Yeah, it's very topical to, like, 1936, 35, when he's writing it. It's not a general interest book. It's very much about that situation. And consequently, I mean, they weren't kidding when they said lightly annotated. There's only just a couple of underlines, but some interesting things. Actually, only one, really. There was no real evidence that McLuhan even read past page 30 something, but maybe he did.
Right.
He underlined this one part, the paradox, which Lewis explains that the extremist of the right, like right wing, the extremist of the right is the most truly pacific person upon the stage. And, you know, saying obviously, I guess even back then it was the same, that just obviously the right wingers have more of the reputation as being the hawks or warmongers.
Yeah.
Saying when you think about it, he basically explained it that it's like the right wingers generally feel that we took a wrong turn at some point, the extremist ones, they generally feel that we took a wrong turn at some point and we need to get back to something, like we lost our way as a people and there's something.
The right wingers favor individualism. They're sort of libertarian.
Yeah, and it usually comes down to that kind of individualist freedom thing versus a collectivization. And the point is, like, yeah, they might be warmongers, but they actually do want a peace. They want to return to a certain other way of doing it. They want to correct the course of society and then leave it that way. Like, whereas the left-wing extremists are more... They have a more total vision of a never-ending revolution and never-ending perfecting and
tinkering
with the, and like constant change and mutation of the society to like a sort of a transhuman, ultra-collectivized destiny or something.
Yes.
And so in a way, they're more violent because their war will never end.
That's right. And Lewis... if you look at the book much, we need to find out if he knows the radio effect yet. He may not. He may not know the he's talking about collectivism in the 20s and the art of being ruled, but I don't know if he's understood the media magic in all of it. He might.
Well, I didn't read the whole thing. I only read the first 30 pages or so closely, and I flipped a little through later. I didn't see anything about radio, but he was making one good point about a media kind of thing. Later on in the book.
But as long as there's one good point, that's all that really matters.
Yeah, as long as it's just the one, it was worth it. He's talking about this, how there had been a recent move, some kind of a recent maneuvering in response, I think, to Italy and warring in Abyssinia or something.
Yeah, Ethiopia, yeah.
That British diplomatic situation. This technique of statesmanship by a pretense of open diplomacy in an international parliament and, or combined with, organized press polemic, so that on the one hand, in the theater of the League of Nations, you've got a pretense of an open diplomacy, but then as part of the same thing, you've got this massive press, newspaper pressure thing. And over the top, whatever, and with absolutely money and everything. And what he's saying is the idea that this will be employed for this occasion only is what feels extremely unlikely. Indeed, it has been very improbable that it will ever stop. From the left-wing standpoint, it has been far too effective ever to let it subside. The press will now be in an uproar indefinitely.
And well, so is that annotated by McLuhan?
No, there's no. There were no marks that I saw from McLuhan at all past past page 35.
Maybe he agrees too much with Lewis. He may agree too much with Lewis to bother noting anything. He accepts everything.
It could be because this is a very it's a very good point, this idea that, you know, once a good new either medium or use of the medium, like once they figure out a new play, once something gets implemented, it never goes away.
Yeah. Once created, it never goes on. Now, I've been reading Harold Innes's idea file, all these notes he wrote that people didn't know about until it was published in 1980, and he's very influenced by Lewis, and he goes into detail the battle between the radio and the newspaper and this media stuff in the 20s and 30s, in detail, in his notes. So I think Innes is following up on what he got from Lewis.
That's cool. That's a good idea, because, yeah, he was into Lewis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In his one essay, The Bias of Communication, the one where he gives his personal plea for solutions, or his solution, it's called The Plea for Time, he ends it by quoting about 8 different thoughts from Wyndham Lewis. That's how he ends his personal plea.
Yeah.
So, you were going to say?
Wyndham Lewis is really pretty valuable all over.
Yeah.
In a way, a lot of times, especially for his time.
He's definitely trying to be the anti-environment. Whatever the general thought is, he's going to come up with a contrary thought, saying the right wingers are pacifists. And Lewis is trying to bring in peace in these books and pamphlets he's doing in the mid-30s. And I've got this new essay he wrote in 1945 at the end of the war where he predicts the bomb. It gets published in the C1E Review before August 45. But in it, he says that his whole effort to have peace in the 30s was misguided. And it's a reassessment of all that you're reading there in 1945. It's pretty interesting.
Well, that's definitely interesting, because at the beginning of the book, he's talking about this, how there was still this idea, you know, they talk about World War I was supposed to be the war to end all wars or something.
Yeah.
And he's commenting that in the 30s, this sense is very still very much alive, where people are like, in order, like, the way to peace is through and across this big patch of war. Like, we need what we need is a really good big war, and then we can have peace, like, forever. And so Lewis is saying, like, he clarifies his position at the beginning of the book, that he's like, I'm definitely against war. I'm definitely trying to avoid war. But he's like, but I also don't trust any of these people that say they're for peace, because being for peace, that's very abstract. If you're for war or against war, that's much more concrete, you know? But for being for peace usually means, yeah, by some means that is probably not something pretty, you know?
Well, that's interesting.
If this ends up in the LaRouche quadrant, we're going to have trouble, Bob.
No, it won't. We're in the McLuhan quadrant. Back off. It's okay. We're still in the McLuhan quadrant. But that's interesting you say that, Brian, because maybe what he says in this article, 1945, he already had that awareness in the Left Wing's book, you know, that he wasn't naively for peace. So it's a complicated essay in 1945. He's also criticizing the United Nations, which is just being organized. So Lewis is, again, topical, up on all the stuff that's happening, and has his opinion and his perspective. And always bringing in the technological factor as the ultimate cause of everything going on.
Yeah.
So maybe he's not so simplistic
the most interesting developments on the stage are the technological ones.
Right. And I haven't read Left Wings Over Europe, but some of the critics, like Paul Edwards, they talk about, they're on the defense of these professors who defend Lewis, so they're saying, no, he was for peace, you know, trying to work for peace and stop war in the 30s, but maybe it wasn't so simplistic as you're pointing out, as the professors imply.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. He was definitely, he's trying to make, you know, as usual, a complicated point that just, you can say I'm definitely against war. I'm definitely working against that, you know, but it's a more complicated thing.
But he always, his job is always to show the complexities that are going on due to technological factors that the average thinking from the left, right, center aren't acknowledging. He's always pointing out the invisible simplicity that's happening.
Yeah. For sure.
Like, he doesn't have a solution, but he said, we need to know this and we need to know that to understand why we're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So he's considered
valuable.
What?
He's very valuable that way.
Yeah, he's considered an evil guy, and yet he's the most balanced thinker among them, because people weren't used to having the balanced view, what McLuhan called the technique of suspended judgment. People were very into their national perspectives and visual space in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, a point of view of something.
Yeah, that was like a national sacredness, a pagan religion to have a point of view.
I've been thinking about this idea that writing is 50 years behind painting, that Brian Geisen said.
Yeah.
And then Burroughs would say, like, he's right. I mean, cut-ups are only just getting to a cubist point.
Right.
But it's interesting, like, well, what about this trying to add, how far behind is philosophy or sociology, you know, like with a Lewis and a McLuhan, like,
that's
what truly cupid sociology going on.
Well, you got to bring in the media dynamics that McLuhan brings in to clarify that. McLuhan says sociology and psychology is the last gasp of literature after Ulysses. In other words, books still carry on, but now people are doing sociological big view patterning and psychological details. That is the last gasp of books, which then becomes New Age books in the 70s and 80s. Now, back to this, one thing about Geisen, these guys, whatever they are, they ignore the vortices. Here's Pound, Lewis, and Eliot, and Joyce doing, catching literature, at least poetry, up to the cubists. Now, Zappa comes in and says music was way behind. He thought he had to catch music up to the modernists.
Yeah, totally.
But, you know, Geis and them, they don't know about Lewis, or they don't want to deal with Lewis and the vortices part. Look at The Enemy of the Stars, that tremendous play that came out in 1914, 1915, that anticipated Beckett, or Beckett was inspired by it. You know, Crabbe's Last Tape and that. Mm-hmm. This is the big missing thing in art history. Not so much maybe the last 5 years since Lewis has been getting play in the big museums in London, but for 100 years. And that's what McLuhan wrote in on. Everybody had missed Lewis, and that's all he used was Lewis.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's very, there are few things that give you more leverage than discovering a truly fertile, untapped resource.
Yeah.
You know, or undertapped resource.
Now, I would probably say this is all a bunch of crap, but let's take what did Lewis do on a clarity level, Ion? Did he do anything on the clarity level?
Hasn't got clear yet. You're going to end up in the LaRouche quadrant before it's over with. No good can come of this.
Well, he doesn't end up in the LaRouche quadrant. The LaRouches accuse him of ending up in their quadrant, but he doesn't.
Right.
So,
well, there it is. So there you go. Good. And what's the difference?
I mean, you're saying that Lewis is still going.
The queen is going to put something very bad in your bum. Don't you worry.
So you're saying that Lewis is still developing right now?
Yes.
That's interesting. See, Brian, we include the post-death guff experience in the creativity of the artist. So it's like we're warning Lewis, you're heading to the LaRouche quadrant. You can't take Dobstown. Dobstown's too much for him.
Right.
And I had that experience this week. Some kind of fake researcher, guy's name was Jan Irvin. He started emailing me, and he's linked in things that no one else has really done. He's taking a LaRouche perspective. He's anti MK Ultra, and he's anti the LSD people. But he links McKenna, McLuhan, Walter Boward, Mark Stallman,
and Peter
Beter. Miller. Not to Peter Beter. I don't know if he knows about him. And Dobbs, too. We are the secret network that ruined his generation.
Right.
And he started interviewing me today, this week, but he quickly freaked out and ran away. But that showed up. The LaRouche quadrant did show up this week. So it is relevant in Ion saying that we did end up in the LaRouche quadrant this week.
Yeah, and I mean, talking about Lewis's politics and Lewis being suppressed, it's definitely a veering in a LaRouche quadrant direction to be wondering, like, I mean, how much of an enemy of one of, you know, how much could Lewis really be among the pantheon of the enemies of the, you know, the bad guy artist of the LaRouche quadrant if he's so
if the BBC is slandering him so bad.
Right. Now, he does a total switch after World War II. He gets back to London as accepted and becomes the top critic for Listener and on the radio, and he produces another three or four books.
And then Hemingway says something that decides to recommend him to his mom rather than continue to be pissed off.
Yeah, Hemingway said that Lewis, when he knew him back in the 20s and 30s, had the eyes of a rapist, but he changed his view later.
Yeah.
An unsatisfied rapist at that.
yeah, right.
So what's next? What's the next note?
Well, the other book that I got out was Revolution for the Hell of It by Abby Hoffman.
Okay. And now, let me tell you a story before you do it. Abby Hoffman says that he was he called McLuhan one day in 68 at the height of the yippie thing in that book, that period. And he said McLuhan wouldn't engage any prose. He wouldn't say sentences. He just kept saying to Abby Hoffman, no matter what Abby said, he just kept saying, the medium is the message, the medium is the message, the medium is the message. All he said to Abby Hoffman. And,
wow.
Abby was quite shocked by this professor being so street crude.
Well, McLuhan was trying to point out that Abby was the medium that he was talking about.
Well, he was.
And Abby never got it.
No, he didn't. Abby didn't get it. He was shocked at the rudeness of McLuhan. But, Abby's a rude yippie, so McLuhan did a yippie thing back at him.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, it seems to be kind of an Allen Ginsberg reference or something to, like, the idea of that you're sort of mildly subverting what's he going to say? What wisdom is he going to give?
Steal this book.
That's the next book, Ion. The first one is Revolution for the Hell of It, right? That's the title?
Yeah.
So what does McLuhan have many annotations in that?
Not too many.
But I'd like to hear them.
The one that he actually wrote a little note beside, a passage that he seemed to really like, seems to me like maybe his opinion of Abby Hoffman might, as a writer or whatever, might have been, well, like when he's really on, he can sort of be pretty Lewisian. This is pretty good. There's this one page where there are a couple different notes on the back page. Further down the page is something about dress and costume, cops as kind of a costume. Question, part of the segment, one of the segments that McLuhan seemed to like the most and get the most out of was a segment in the middle of the book where he's interviewing himself, and it includes, he asks himself, do you like McLuhan? And gives a short answer that basically finishes up like, let's say I respect him but don't love him.
Yeah,
like, he experiments. He does he does good for an old guy, but his lifestyle, their university Catholic,
Mayor
Grant. What I am?
With? Mayor Vishner.
Mayor Vishner. I think he was JDL. Might have been the Jewish Defense League, but just a second. So McLuhan noted the parts where Abby talked about him.
Yeah, that was its own separate note. Instead of the notes on the back page, there was a little, with nothing written beside it, but page 58 had been written on the front title page.
And yeah.
The one where he asks, do you like McLuhan? And he mentioned, Abby Hoffman also says, he says, his assistant, Quentin Fiore, is more McLuhan than McLuhan.
That's partly true. Fury does the book, The Medium is a Massage. He does the album. He does all the design. And McLuhan didn't respect the album. Well, he was always counter-environment, so if everybody's loving the album, he would say it was crap. He would say Medium is a Massage was not a book. So he did not limit himself to the flashiness that Quentin Fury did in the design. And now Quentin Fury is famous. He and Jerome Agel, there's been a book on the techniques that Agel used on the McLuhan books. It was a revolution in book design. But Marshall was not interested in temporary aesthetic issues.
Yes. Well, I almost feel like it makes me wonder if Abby Hoffman called him, if he had already read that in Revolution for the Hell of It, and if his response...
Yeah, it's Abbott. We prefer Abbott.
Abbott and McCullough.
Abbott what? Abbott Hoffman?
Yes.
Now, Ion's starting to, he's been weaving themes, Brian, so he may be starting on a theme that we have to figure out. There's an Abbott Hoffman, a Meyer Vishner.
Abbott and Costello?
Maybe. We have to look up. Somebody's got to look up Abbott Hoffman and Google these things, because Ion is making a point, which will become a theme.
Okay.
Abbott Hoffman.
Okay.
He's Abbott? What, you're changing his name?
No, that is his name.
Abbott? Ah, okay.
Yes.
I'm going to have to check that myself. I don't trust anybody on that point. I'm going to go...
And Thomas King Forcade.
Oh, now that is a very appropriate name. Now, that guy, do you know that name?
No, I don't.
He is the King Yippie who founded High Times, major dope dealer for Abbie Hoffman and everybody in New York City, and he gets investigated. He's one of the first guys to get investigated by the police, and he dies very early. He is a hero to Dean Latimer and all the High Times Yippies. So there's Ion. He knows his stuff.
Yeah.
Thomas Forcade, very influential guy in New York City in 68, 69. So that means Meyer Vishnu. That's, maybe Meyer Vishnu is a Yippie. It sounds so familiar, that name. Vishner, N-E-R, Ion? Yeah, Yippie. Meyer Vishner, 64, Yippie anti-war activist.
Okay.
And he runs, he died. He died 2 years ago. He looks so aged and decrepit.
Go on down. We just posted the CIA file, the letters, the actual CIA intel.
Where,
keep going down. It's great. And
I look? Wait, go down. What?
In your box.
In my box.
In your box.
Okay. He just posted his file. Let's see. That didn't come in yet.
Don't tell anybody.
Okay. But, okay, so Meyer Vishnu. So he's listing all of... Abby's friends here. This is what, Thomas
Forkin.
Right. The Vishner, he died August 22nd at the age of 64 in the McDougal Street apartment where he made his home for more than 30 years. That would be right beside where Dylan had an apartment at that period. His death, for which he had long planned and called his existential project, came after he took an overdose of Seconal. It was a project often delayed because Mayer wanted to be as considerate of others in death as he was in life. A week before he died, he had gone with a friend, the filmmaker Justin Shine, to visit a writer friend, Michael Ventura, in Lubbock, Texas, very close, with whom Meyer left his cat. So he found a place. Now, Paul Krasner, who we featured...
Pickles, is that you?
Pickles. Yeah. Paul Krasner said that Meyer could not be dissuaded, and he spoke with Meyer by phone the morning that he died. So he's doing this slow suicide and thanking everybody. And Paul told him, "I would miss him, but that was my problem, not his." He said, "Thank you." The purpose of his life was to end it. Meyer dictated the death notice that I put in the New York Times, says Krasner. Vishner Meyer, forced into this life February 13, 1949, left on purpose August 22nd, 2013.
Wow. That was pretty recent.
Yeah, that's 2013. Afflicted with depression for many years, Meyer was in physical pain the last few years, according to Shine, who was his partner in the LaGuardia Corner Gardens, where, unlike most gardeners, Meyer grew vegetables. Meyer was a Yippie activist and associate with Abbie Hoffman. He was a friend of singer Phil Oakes, of Tom Forcade, founder of High Times magazine, and of Ed Sanders, a Yippie co-founder and member of the Fugs. In 1971, Meyer edited, quote, "When the Mode of the Music Changes, an anthology of rock and roll lyrics." Long associated with the War Resisters League, Meyer wrote for their magazine, Wind. I used to go to those guys' meetings back in the 90s. They still were doing it, the War Resisters League. They didn't have many words to resist, but they were still getting together, trying to organize something. And he had a funny TV show. He edited the L.A. Weekly. Now, that's amazing. That's what Jerry Fiocca used to read in the 80s. Culture paper
and AJ Weberman too. We even included John Lennon's FBI file, but don't tell anybody.
AJ Weberman is certainly part of this. He returned to New York at the end of the decade and became an assistant manager of St. Mark's Bookshop. You ever been to St. Mark's, Brian?
Yeah, I have.
The top bookstore, and it's the leftist, postmodern John Baudrillard Coker Books, and it's owned by the founder of Prevention magazine. who Carolyn was.
Right about Captain Nussbaum.
Captain Nussbaum. I don't know that name. Captain Nussbaum?
Chaplain. Chaplain Nussbaum.
Okay. I was reading the files. Nussbaum, B-O-M-B. Grammys?
N-U-S-B-A-U-M. Nussbaum.
Oh, yes. N-U-S. Yes, that one. B-A-U-M. Kaplan Nussbaum. Is that N-A-U-S or N-U-S? Hey?
N-U-S. In your inbox. In your inbox. In your inbox.
Okay.
All the news that is news across the non-physical nation.
Right. Here's I was just ripping off abbyhoffman.org. And it's called Revolution for the Hell of It. It has pictures of Meyer Vishnu.
All that wasn't there till just now.
Look at that, Brian. He created an instant website. Now, here's what it says.
Go down.
It says all three of these dudes, Forcade, Vishner, and Hoffman, killed themselves.
Whoa,
but that's not true. We know that Abby was murdered.
Yeah.
Well, only I know that. And it's a big article by A.J. Weberman. So, very good research, Ion. Fast Googling. Mm-hmm. So, what does Ion say about Abby? Any other thoughts?
Keep going down.
None of them had to kill themselves if they took the completement formulas and listened to Ion. That's what they were looking for, but they were too eagle-eyed to notice.
Well, the present guy they're trying to kill, as I was telling you the other day, is Dana Beale. Remember Dana Beale? We went to the Yippie place in 2000. There, walking around. Summer of 2007, we went to Dana Beale's... where Yipster Times and all these guys stayed on Bleecker Street. That was their place. So
okay,
the
redacted stuff. We redacted some of the stuff because you'll put this all over the place, likely. So the redacted stuff was to protect the innocent.
Yeah, but did you create all this? I mean, if they created it, it's out in the public. There's nothing to be afraid of. But you stuck extra stuff in there? Which he can do, Brian. It's actually a good site. A lot of archives, a lot of stuff. So that's Abby Hoffman, ABBIEHOFFMAN.org, Brian, if you want to look at it sometime.
Okay.
If you know
Lord,
about Forcade.
Catch. Now aren't you glad, Dr. Dean, that we redacted all that crap? He just told the whole wide world forever.
Right. Okay, Brian, give us another McLuhan comment on Abby Hoffman.
Well, when he's interviewing himself, he asks himself if he hates cops, and he gives a qualified yes. He's like, but he emphasizes the dress, the costume, and McLuhan has a note on the back page with this about dress and costume and police.
East Village Other, Bob.
Walter Bower. Yeah. Did I mention that this guy who investigated me this week included Walter Bower, Tim Leary, me, Marshall McLuhan? He lumped Marshall McLuhan in there as this profound intelligence network that destroyed everybody, and nobody was on to us until this guy, Jan Irvin. He figured it out, and he's out to get me. But what did Ian just say? It's important. Who did he just name?
Each other.
This costume thing, what McLuhan was saying in 68 and 69, he said, the policeman on the beat walking around with his little checkoff book or handing out tickets is not cool. The young kids like the cops who are dressed in costume on the motorcycles. So here's Abby saying he likes the costume. He's following
not
totally.
That he likes the costume. He's saying that, without the costume, he says, like, naked, then the police are my brother, you know? And he said, he commented, have you ever seen a fight in a steam bath? McLuhan wrote that out on the back cover in his note. You'd never see a fight in steam bath.
The Flamingo Park Papers.
Their costume.
Yeah, I see that, Ian. I just want to comment on that, Brian. Abby Hoffman is like the John Birchers, tribally opposed to being tribal. Now, the hippies are into individual, do-your-thing autonomy, And they don't like tribal costuming. They call the straight guy as if following a corporate costume. So here he is, he's saying, take off your clothes, Mr. Policeman, stop being a corporate uniform. So Abbie Hoffman is being a rearview mirror POB, print oriented bastards, against the put on of the costume, which is natural in the TV age. And he wants to return to the subjectivist view, which is you stand naked before the world. That's what McLuhan said. The objectivist, I think the objectivist stands naked before the world, and the subjectivist puts on the world as his clothing. That was the distinction McLuhan made. So Abby's in there, the opposite of what he thinks he is, because he's using media tribalism to get attention, but he represents POB values.
Well, I mean, or the uniform. He says costume there, but I guess he would. He was trying to distinguish between uniform and costume, but yeah, I get
There's
a rear view mirror there still. But.
Right. The important thing is that McLuhan is commenting on what Abbie says about Marshall stuff, whether Abbie knows it or not.
You see,
he's looking for what relates to what Marshall has said in his own script, and there's Abbie talking about the costume factor. That would be something Marshall would note.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that, well, it's just he made the one note that McLuhan actually wrote out on the page is it refers to two different things on the page. The one of them is further down the page.
Aaron K.
He is the Yippie Pie Man. Did you ever hear of him? The guy who would put the famous people put a pie in their face?
Oh, right. Yeah, no, that gesture survived.
Yeah, now every one of these guys, Aaron Kay, all these people, are on Bob Fass every week. You can listen to Bob Fass' show in the limping along WBAI network in New York that has no money anymore. They don't even have a radio station.
CKLN.
And Bob Fass, he told Gerd Stern to tell Bob to give him a call, so we have to call Bob soon. But I have a pretty good archive of some of his best shows over the last few years on FiveBody.com. Look up Bob Fass, F-A-S-S, and you'll hear Aaron Kay and friends of Tom Forcade and Abbie Hoffman and old tapes of – see, Abbie Hoffman would report during the Chicago 7 or Chicago 8 trial on Bob Fass' show. Constantly, because Bob Fass was on every night. So it was a huge archive. And there's now a movie about Bob Fass and that show called Radio Unnameable, if you want to look it up, a documentary. Huh. But they're all the same gang. They created the yippie media excitement in the late 60s in New York City. And most people outside of New York City would be reading the East Village Other and getting whiffs of it, but they didn't know what was going on in New York City with the radio environment that Bob Fass had.
Right. Well, that sounds cool. That sounds familiar, that Radio Unnameable. I wonder if...
Well, I used to post it in Five Body. You would recognize it from me posting it for many years. And Bob Fass, they're all 80. Paul Krasner, we had him on the show, or we played him. I used to call, on my timeline, you can hear me calling in and talking to them. It's through
tiny
that
note,
Tiny note chart. Yeah, I was the tiny note. And I discovered Gerd Stern on the Bob Fass show. And
We like Gerd Stern.
Are you quoting Mark Stallman? Are you quoting Mark Stallman? He's doing Mark Stallman, who of all the hits, because Mark Stallman was LaRouche's bodyguard. So LaRouche, Mark doesn't like any of these guys, but Gerd Stern passed the test. He said, of all those idiotic Gnostic hippies, Gerd Stern's the only sane one. Said Mark Stallman. And I caught him, Brian. I caught Ion not expressing his point of view by quoting Mark Stallman. Pretty perceptive on my part.
And the crowd erupts with elation.
I'm sure that goes on more than most would suspect, right, Ion?
I think you might have mumbled
there's
the words
a segue.
Much.
There's a segue there, sure.
Where did you say, Brian?
That the idea that Ion is quoting someone rather than expressing his point of view. That probably goes on more than
we know. Last week he did the whole...
segue.
Yes, he's always quoting other people. And last week he was quoting the lineup for the Kentucky Derby with things like far right and this and that. We thought he was making political comments, but he was just quoting a horse's name.
Wow.
You can see that on Ion and Bob. It's a good collage.
Excellent.
Yummy, yummy trifecta.
Yes, trifecta. Tom Forcade. If you don't know about Tom Forcade, he is the real hero. They all worshipped him because he was a huge dope dealer, and it's his money that's funded a lot of stuff, and he started High Times magazine. And I went to the 1999 New Year's Eve party in New York for the High Times big deal. And who are the rappers that the Ku Klux Klan, the Wu-Tang Klan, they were the featured band. You know, the Wu-Tang.
Right, not that. Sure.
You know who I mean. They're pro-dope-smoking rappers.
I think it's Wu-Tang. It's a Wu-Tang, isn't it, Bob?
Yeah, Wu-Tang, right. Wang Wu-Tang. And so all the guys that we're talking about, and they made a big tribute to Tom Forcade. They still remember him, everybody. He's a big deal. He's probably the one they all respect more than Abby or anybody. And you never heard of him, Brian.
That's right. No, I didn't.
Yeah, he's worth looking up. And
I guess I kind of passed over that scene pretty quickly. I was into the whole Hoffman, Leary, Watts.
You were into the LSD part, not the activism part.
Well, I was into the reading the books about the whole scene, man.
Yeah.
But I, rocketed past that as well. So
right into the arms of McLuhan.
Oh yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, that's. And they're all
in time you get past the William Irwin Thompson quadrant, you're going to end up something in your bum. We're just saying.
You're going the wrong direction. LaRouche is south of Thompson. Or north of Thompson.
No,
we're going south.
But see, you get, it's going south for
then
sure.
Then I know which way the wind's going, too. The wind
then
is in my face.
Then, correct, and it depends on which way you're facing. That's right.
Yeah,
you're facing north, it's blowing south, or vice versa.
Yeah, if I'm facing Carolyn and the wind is blowing at me and it's coming from the south, that's a north wind because it's going north. You categorize the wind by where it's headed.
Hey. Correct. Not from where it came from. That's the rearview mirror response, and that's what's wrong with your chart.
You don't start knocking my chart. There's nothing wrong with my chart. It includes everything.
You just don't know the direction. Fine, wonderful. You just don't know which direction it's blowing from, not to.
Oh, no, I got that. It's right there in the middle column, all the directions, the arrows. You see the arrows are pointing. But, hey, Brian, let's not get distracted by him. The Wyndham Lewis
arrows,
among us.
Yeah.
Ion is the Wyndham Lewis among us. But
well,
now what's
we can T.S. Eliot you right in the next Tuesday also.
but Brian, you've got Abbie Hoffman is a big skeptical of McLuhan. Ginsberg skeptical. Forward even. He wanted to meet McLuhan, but he still said Marshall was standing on the sidelines. They all objected to Marshall being on the sidelines and not down in the street. You know what I mean?
All right.
And so McLuhan maintained on that level. He was in the street in other ways. He was in the chip body street, but McLuhan maintained the visual enemy position. And they all noticed it. It's just like Lewis. All these people knew Lewis in the 20s, 30s, but they didn't trust him. You know,
right.
They knew there was a detachment that was not healthy. It was antisocial.
Yeah, would never be any kind of party man.
That's right.
Eric still doesn't trust him.
That's right. I know what Eric says about his father.
Mm.
but carry on, Brian. Any other notations?
Yeah. Okay, well, I was still trying to get to this one. So there's this one quote that McLuhan puts a nice check mark beside. I mean, it's just a check mark, but it feels like he really dug it. It's a very quote where after Abby had mentioned that, talking about dancing, and noted in passing that they stopped naming dances. Some point in the 60s or whatever, a new craze dances, there were no longer dances with names. That would
by 68, that's right.
And McLuhan did note that. And then Abbie Hoffman goes on to say, dance schools are about as outmoded as public schools, which really are archaic. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that Arthur Murray was U.S. Commissioner of Education. High school, just a training ground for millions of foxtrotters.
Now, that's McLuhan would really be interested in that because he used to talk about the Watusi he knew the dance names in the mid-60s. You hear him on the Tony Schwartz recordings talking about it. So he would note that they faded out, but basically that was the effect of color TV. Color TV made everybody go static, the kinetic American hyperculture with the color TV effect made everybody sit down and go on inner trips. They stopped dancing at the psychedelic things. They might whirl around a little bit, but basically everybody was watching their stoned imagery.
Yeah, it's it emerged later as an actual name for a type of music, but it stretches to the 60s for sure. The shoegaze.
What's that?
The genre of music. Shoegaze is the name of a genre of music, basically like the people listening to it at the show.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're staring at their shoes.
We played that, and I looked it up, and they called it shoegaze music. That's right.
Right.
Would that be linked to Northern Soul? That kind of dancing, that kind of music?
Northern Soul, I don't think so. I'm not sure. I mean, it would be more like a Velvet Underground, drone-y, drone rock sort of route.
But. Right. So now what happened is when the instant replay came in and changed the effect of color TV in the early 70s, eventually the gay clubs brought in disco, and then people started dancing again by 75.
Right. Well, and then that... not that every disco band, it's possible to do disco with a live drummer, but it was as if it took the machine percussion and the drum machines to really get people dancing again, or at least on a total four on the floor beat, like the thump, 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 thump.
Right. Is the drum machine used to disco?
I think some old disco does, but
okay.
Not necessarily that the drum machine is being used as, like, that is going to be the basic music of the drum machine and new multi-decade obsession with a four-on-the-floor constant beat that way. That doesn't have any variation except within just the up and down thump, 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 thump.
Right. Basically. So that sounds like the Android meme simulation of the dancing America culture of the first two-thirds of the century. The Android Mean comes in the 70s and 80s and just plays a virtual drum thing, keeps the meme going.
Yeah, and it kind of symbolizes a flattening out and making an ersatz ground out of the tetrad.
Yes, which drove Johnny Watt rotten crazy. The punks reacted to this. They were pissed.
Right, yeah, disco was the worst. Sure.
Yeah. Did you ever disco, Ion? Did you support that movement? Where is Ion? Did he leave? Let's check that. No, he's still here. He's just not going to comment on that, I guess. They don't do...
No, we're trying to get you back into the real world.
Well, what is the real world? What's that mean? I don't think so. This is pretty real, going over McLuhan's observations.
The note that McLuhan wrote above, he put a check mark beside that line about, I wouldn't be surprised if Arthur Murray, the dance school guy, was the commissioner of education, and high school just a training ground for millions of foxtrotters. McLuhan put a check mark beside that, and above it he wrote, note, the teacher in America has never gone for a dress even as much as the businessman.
Never gone for a dress. I mean, they
underline A as in like one. Here's what a teacher wears. Well, much less so than other.
Well, dress is private, and costume is the opposite of dress. Is he saying that teachers wore costumes?
No, I think he's saying that like more that differently than most of the other. You know, like as a kid, it's like here's a cartoon of a scientist, a doctor, a fireman, a businessman wearing the suit, a judge wearing that.
Yeah.
Thing, that. A lot of different professions, they all wear the same thing. And McLuhan's noting that the teachers have never really had that.
Oh, okay. He's saying they didn't go to costume. They're literary. They're holding up Gutenberg private values. They're not putting on the electric age.
Yes,
that's what he means.
Yeah, that's
Carry on, Wayward Son, Kansas.
Is that a novel? Sounds familiar.
Sounds like it.
Or do you mean the band Kansas, Ion?
Yes.
Yeah, Kansas was a band. I would like me to play that. I'm under instructions.
Or at least read the words. Or at least read the words, at least.
Oh, okay.
Play it for sure.
I will just play it for a second here. I've got to bring on the sound vibe. Just a second, Brian.
No problem.
We'll see. Where is
somebody look up the lyrics and have them ready.
Yeah, Kansas. Sound. Where's sound? There it is. Okay. Sound, volume's up. So this is Kansas, late 60s, I guess.
Carry on my wayward son. There'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more.
Yelling out the lyrics, but I want you to hear him, but he just hung up. So back to, hey, this is a good song. Now you get what this is saying, Brian. This is the archetypal suburban kid, you know, trying to find their way in the late 60s. This is what the lyrics are about.
It gets better, too. It gets better, too.
Okay.
Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more.
Thank you. think it's grinding to a halt. Well, I have to congratulate you. You've turned me on to a song I never knew about. Now, the discussion below it is hilarious. This is the tribal. If you want to read the modern mind, the way they're yelling and arguing over the phone, over the song, some people are claiming it was influenced by someone else, and this and that, and then other people are insulting each other. And if somebody says, can't we just say this is a good fucking song? Is anybody here because of a good fucking song? Because everybody's accusing of being there because of another band called Supernatural. And several right. people don't know what is Supernatural. But is this an 80s song? Is Kansas an 80s band? I thought this was 70s.
I don't know.
Anyway, so good choice there, Ion. The lyrics are very archetypal. It's like written by an like a psychological department. About the profile and concerns of a young kid who's got his right hemisphere activated for various environmental reasons. What's the next thought, Brian?
That the part that McLuhan seemed to like the best, a connected point over a couple of different pages. He has a note on page 27 connected to two other pages. He has it noted to. And on 27 is he's got all these underlines for Hoffman says, the key to the puzzle lies in theater. We are theater in the street, total and committed. All of that is underlined. And we aim to involve people and use, unlike other movements, Lockean ideology, any weapon, brackets, prop, we can find. And McLuhan underlines any weapon and prop.
Yeah, now this is really the significance here. I'm going to start reading later, after Ion stops, if Ion does stop, we're going to start reading the do line, the executive newsletter McLuhan put out starting in July 68 when this book probably came out around that time. We're going to start reading the content of the do line, which 99% of the world has not heard because it's too hard to find the thing, and it was very expensive for people back then. The first issue is about the global theater. And it's no longer Global Village, but it's the Global Theater. And McLuhan's commenting on the young people becoming actors in the Global Theater. And that's why he's underlying that. There's proof that the figure for 68, 69, Abbie Hoffman, is claiming to be in a theater. See, like it's a total knee-jerk reflex that Abbie Hoffman is doing that he doesn't recognize.
Yeah, and McLuhan is just reporting the intelligence that he got from the guy who is doing it fairly consciously.
Who would that be?
Hoffman. Like he read it. That's what Abbie Hoffman says. He passes it on.
But he's saying that Hoffman is a figure for the new environment.
Right, right.
There's Corbin calling in. Corbin wants to make some more.
Corbin, hello, Corbin. How you doing, Corbin? Come see you sometime.
but see, McLuhan is there saying that Abbie is living too much in the now. The nowness of now, just reacting to the latest technology. Yeah, we have to wait till it picks up. And he probably heard us talking about him, so he wants to comment on it. I mean, I'm not going to unmute him. He's on the show. He's on the conference call. So he's listening to the message.
The other underlying parts that McLuhan connects to that on other pages.
This is it. Corbin's in his studio. This is a Berklee Music School graduate here. He is. He went to Juilliard or Berklee. I can't remember which. And there it is. Thank you, Corbin. In the previous message we didn't hear, he was saying the lyrics to this one song. So Kansas is an early 70s band, and they do say Carry On Wayward Son was a hit. And Dust in the Wind, that sounds familiar, Dust in the Wind. I think I've heard of that one.
Hmm. Tonight. No, that's Snatch in the Crack.
Okay, so back to what you were saying. So do you see that,
right,
McLuhan is saying you're not an activist. Lewis said the same thing. You're not a revolutionary if you're just responding to the impulses and ideas that have come into your head due to the new invisible environment.
Right.
You're just responding knee-jerk and have no real comprehensive perspective. So he...
Yeah. And Hoffman is absolutely in that. Like, he refuses to try to, Hoffman's, like, wisdom is to not, is to
speak,
second-guessing that.
Yeah, do not respond to this now.
Hope it's theater urge.
He ends up confused in the later decade. He goes communist, he has to go underground, he has to, and then he surfaces, and then they murder him. I mean, he's a loose ends, a few years later, because his time, his effect has gone, and now it's Disco Duck.
First, well, I remember a later book of
Disco Duck.
Later book of Hoffman's was called "Steal This Urine Test."
Yes,
he seized on that as being an ultimate kind of like now that they're not even your pee is free. he got latched onto that kind of body invasion.
He never saw the discarded condition. He only was worried about the fate of the chemical body. And so at best he comes out. That's in the 80s under Reagan, steal this urine test. You can see it. He's just fixated on the chemical body. And then he tried to, like Leary, he tried to become a comedian. And I saw him.
The parts that McLuhan underlined were about the theater, not just constantly being theater in the streets, and not ghettoizing the theater in a theater house, but unleashing theater everywhere.
Right.
That also says our goal is to remain a mystery, pure theater. And on another page, that was underlined, and McLuhan also underlines, well, the answer is that you create a myth. Something that people can play a role in, can relate to.
Yeah, and so McLuhan had said the year before in McLuhan Hot and Cool that the younger kids, the baby boomers, live mythically. You see, he's underlying is like McLuhan's a corporate psychiatrist, and he's pointing out the symptoms of disorientation this young man is going through. These are telling tales. He's not supporting the idea. He's saying, oh, this poor kid doesn't know what's happening, why he's seeing these things.
Right.
He's underlying technically, not in a supportive way for the ideas.
Yeah, exactly. Scanning for symptoms.
Yeah, for symptoms. And, never got a chance to tell Abby that. He went underground. But I was always going on Bob Fast, pointing these, because they'd always have these guys on, and I'd call in and do McLuhan on them. And they get so pissed at me. And it was hard always knowing that I was going to do it, but I had to come up with different ways, or Bob would hang up on me, because he knew that he respected my McLuhan knowledge. Bob Fast was interested in McLuhan, but you weren't supposed to keep saying the same point. You had to be different every week and say some other stupid thing.
Yeah.
That's another point.
That's the modern education effect, right? I mean,
yes.
You can't pull rings, and now that's enough of that.
And, Kenneth Tynan and the theater critics and the guys, the literati that Lewis Lapham in 94, when he wrote the foreword to the reissue by MIT of Understanding Media, he apologized for all his literati buddies in the 60s who didn't understand McLuhan and should have, because they were all looking for flashy new novels and new writings and new books and new this, new that, and they did not like the fact that McLuhan, they thought, ran out of ideas and was being boring and just had nothing more to say, just kept repeating stuff. They didn't understand the repeat motif of McLuhan.
Even William Irwin Dobson, he said that Fuller and McLuhan both became
autistic.
Replays of themselves.
Yeah, he said they became autistic. They didn't understand that McLuhan was being an artist and a writer as a subset of his quadrophenia. It was not important to be a great artist anymore. He was just doing a technical medical application to the global theater. Meanwhile, he was interacting with students and corporations, doing all this other stuff quadraphenically. That whereas Hoffman and Thompson and everybody are trying to be the great artist, they're still trying to appeal to that New York meme.
Yeah, well, they're still obsessed with the content,
When
Hoffman says, media is free, use it, make news, don't buy ads, he's still talking about making content.
Right. And look at the end.
Multimedia and different canvases that he smears his art project on is much more ambitious.
Who does that?
McLuhan.
Yes. Now, look at this. You just said the information yearns to be free, or something about that. That is the Android memes slogan in the early 90s. Information wants to be free. That's what the Internet was sold on. So Abbie Hoffman had no idea that his slogans would be used by advertising and the tribal people he didn't like as a gimmick for attracting young people to the Internet. And McLuhan, he ends up being the poster child for Wired because his consistently repeated stuff is the only anti-environment that's not exploited by the Android meme. As much as they tried.
Right, right.
Whereas Abbie Hoffman is exploited. Eventually.
Yeah, and much more exploitable.
Yeah, exploitable because he's a chemical body. Are we way off the beam here, Ion? Let's see if he'll have anything to say. Is he telling me to play more music? I have to go back to see where Ion is. Ion dropped off for a while. Sorry. So that means we unmute everybody and everybody can...
All participants are now unmuted.
To say meep. The noise to say meep. Do you guys know this, the anniversary of the Knights Who Say Meep from the Monty Python series?
No. Didn't know that.
Huh? What is it he's talking about?
It's the anniversary. Several anniversaries have happened here in April 2015. Okay.
Yeah.
Yesterday we had 10,000 people, well, more closer to 50,000 up and down the genocide of the Armenian people in 1915 that will not be recognized as a genocide. You know, on the, like the Nazi Jewish genocide, it's all tragedy, but it's all murder. That's what people do. That's what people do for a living, murder. How many people have I murdered? How many people have you murdered, Bob? How many people have you murdered, Brian? How many people have you murdered, Ion or Carolyn? All you've murdered everybody because you hate everybody. You hate. Oh, the cat's crying. Oh, yeah. Yes. Anyway, nonetheless, the Knights Who Say Meep basically came out in 1975. Monty Python, what's the title of the movie, Bobby? Monty Python Chases the Holy Grail or some crazy shit.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah. Nonetheless, they made millions of dollars on the, you know, the buffoonery of the medium of the time. And while you're going back to this McLuhan shit, dude, you are freaking just bringing it. You are an expert on McLuhan. It's like me trying to teach you music. And then you had the balls to actually say last week two things I will point out from last week's show. Towards about 4 a.m. or so, you said 4:18, which you have no clue what that number means.
No, it's a punchline in Aleister Crowley's manifesto. We discovered that recently.
No. You have absolutely no idea what that means. Anyway, nonetheless, and before that, remind me what else went down last week.
Okay, while we're having you remember, I want to acknowledge Scott from CKLN has finally got his shit together, and he's online. Can you speak, Scott? He's coming through SIP, so maybe he can't be picked up. But he is known as RHO on the chat line, and he is someone, Brian, who came to me at CKLN in 1989 or 90 or 87, and had me speak to the local anarchists. And three people showed up in the basement of some, you know, Canadian grant-funded socialist bookstore or something, and Scott became a regular caller, and he discovered us 6 months ago or something, and he's been studying us, deciding whether he wanted to comment on it, and he's finally come in here. I see his name. So we're just saying, hello, Ro. He never would have thought that 35 years ago that that little lecture in the basement of the Anarchist Bookshop would end up here.